Welcome to Foundation Podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Foundation on Apple TV+. I'm Jim.
I am Aaron.
And today we're talking about the season two premiere of Foundation in Selden Shadow. I never thought this day would come. Honestly, I was kind of surprised by the announcement that the show was coming back right now with all the crazy stuff that's happening in Hollywood. But I am grateful because I really enjoyed this episode. Aaron, what'd you think of the premiere?
I'm glad Foundation is back. I was a little surprised. You know, it's one of those things where I'd like kind of lost track of its development, and it had been, you know, not quite 2 years, but going on. And then all of a sudden, like, oh my gosh, season two is coming in. Here's the trailer. And I think that I, from what I've seen so far, that this is a lot much of a piece of the first season. There's, you know, a couple of things that I would have perceived to tighten up going from season one to season two, and I think some of that stuff has happened. But all the things I loved about Foundation season one are here. The big sci-fi ideas, the jaw-dropping visuals. I mean, there is an arrival of a spaceship sequence that is the most majestic, beautiful, impressive special effects sequence I've seen. You know, and also just something like, it's never anything I've seen before. You know, it's just not the arrival of a cool ship at a cool spaceport. It's like, you know, all the world building goes into that is so crazy. And one of the complaints I had last year is there just wasn't enough Jerry Harry. But you know, they're given, it seems like, in his early goings, maybe he'll, you know, go back and into his vaults and various digital guises later on, but like, he got the really strut of stuff.
Man,
this fragmenting psycho mental ego inside this tesseract of his own construction, and him puzzling its way out some of the unreal geometries they had. I thought were just very cool. And some of the things, like, on my first watch, I was like, man, there's not any chemistry between Gale and Salvor. I don't get it. But, like, I actually think that's a textual thing that they're working with. The fact that Salvor is a little disappointed that there isn't this, you know, instant bond between mother and daughter that she, you know, kind of went all in on finding. And that Gale's kind of, like, prickly and off-put and wrong-footed by this whole situation.
It's the strangest parasocial relationship I've seen on television. Because that's what it is, right? Like, Gale does not have these visions of Salvor, but Salvor has her old memories. So, like,
right. All these, like, she's putting all these things in context with something she already knows. And as Gale points out, has had a long time to think about this moment, whereas Gale is just being ambushed, you know? Like, I was not coming to find my daughter at all. So I thought that stuff was inherently interesting. And just, you know, also some of the bigger picture stuff that we're seeing from the Foundation, and some of the hints that we're hearing in this episode. You know, we hear about these magicians. They're doing these miracles in the name of the prophet. Like, that tracks very closely with my memories of how, you know, the Foundation continues to evolve itself socially and in its place in the galaxy. And I think I think there's hints that they're doing this on the show of, like, showing a gradual decay of the Empire and not just in terms of, you know, the genetic drift, but in terms of Empire himself and him being a little bit coarser and baser of a person. There's like a degeneracy, not in like a moral and ethical sense, because it's as far as I can tell, the Emperor's always been bankrupt in those areas, but from like just like the like a prestige and the way people talk, you know, the fact that there
he's making sex jokes in this episode. I don't remember him ever making those jokes before, right? This is
it's a little
drift.
Jarring in the same way we talked about, like, hearing Jean-Luc Picard say the word fuck on Picard is like, whoa. Yep. But like, I think this is an intentional, like, this everything's just kind of slipped a few notches in terms of decorum, in terms of what you're projecting on, and even the universe itself. It seems like, you know, the fact that there these magicians that are starting to peel away the outer rim, you know, in this era of reason, and the fact that, you know, if anything, the Empire is the official religion. Although they did, no, I think they definitively had an official religion last year. But it seems like there is a little bit of erosion of everything happening. And like I talked about this in the preview podcast, the fact that, you know, time as a character, when we revisit the Foundation, you know, lots of familiar faces in the Empire, of course, but you go mm-hmm. back to Foundation, mm-hmm. who the hell are these assholes?
Well, they're, you know, seven generations on or whatever from the last Terminus we knew. And I think that's super interesting.
Yeah.
I was worried about that early on.
Because we went, they established that we went from like Klingon the 13th to the 16th. So we've had an entire
17th maybe.
Or 17th. We've had an entire they're all the Klingons that we knew before are dead.
Yes.
Like at least a generation before this generation. And these are dealing with the realities of their drift. And are we going to go gently into that good night? We're going to try to paddle against the current. And days and dusks of everything and dawns are of different minds. It's great.
Based on this first episode, I think they're doing a great job telling that grand story that Asimov was trying to tell of something bigger than just any one character. It's doing it in a really effective way where I'm feeling like, because I was super nervous about this at the beginning of the show. How are they going to tell this story? How are they going to keep me engaged emotionally with all these characters? And I think they've done a good job with the, you know, liberal application of cryopods. But also the clone thing, I think, has kept that so engaging to me. It's kind of a brilliant addition to the story. And seeing Terminus evolve, I no longer have that worry of like, who are these people? Why do I care about them? They're part of Terminus, you know, they're part of the Foundation. And that's super interesting in itself, getting to know this new wrinkle in the tapestry that is the Foundation. And that's why I think like Foundation and Empire are two, those are the two characters that I care about in this show the most.
Yeah. And the Empire is very personified in a way that the Foundation isn't, but also it's personified in terms of like the way these people look. But, you know, I think we get lots of hints that you'd be between genetic drift and just everything else being distracted, having all these crises, the Empire is not the same character.
No, Empire is changing. And even within the Empire that currently exists, that trifold Empire, there's disputes there's differences of philosophy. How should we approach this? And I think that's fascinating.
Difference in how we relate to our android mommies.
Oh yeah,
you know, return to relationships of the past. Yeah, and like all the stuff that, you know, some of the stuff that kind of like hinted in background, and we talked about how well the show did this in this first season, that like, you know, they'd keep on layering things and layering things on, like it's continuing this episode. Like, you know, it's something that was kind of hinted about, like, yeah, these Klingons ever fucked Imrazel, you know, made very explicit. And, you know, the other thing is like, I had a big question at the end of the season, because it's something that when we were talking to David S. Goyer, one of the creators of the show, you know, he talked about like that they had gotten metrics from Apple and like some feedback, and that they were going to be leaning into some things this season that were successful. And, you know, I remember talking to you about that. It's like, well, if they're leaning into like some of these sci-fi fantasy action sequences, it feels like that they have a mandate that once a week they have to do that. I don't know if I'm excited about that, but if they're leaning into like the really cerebral big picture galaxy, you know, what's it like for a artificial intelligence to go insane, et cetera, like I'll be excited. And if anything, it feels like they're doing both. They're definitely going in for the slick action, but and that's fine. Cause like there's an action sequence that busts out and I'm like, this feels like it's one of those scenes that's just there to kind of titillate and get people's blood pumping, but it becomes a vital part of the plot and it's worked. Mm-hmm. It feels like it is more important. That crazy sex violence scene is a lot more important to the characters and the plot than you might surmise when it's unfolding before your eyes. So
yeah, it's character building in a weird way. You know, this is like some of the Game of Thrones stuff got a little bit gratuitous with
the classic sex position from the first like two seasons. Yeah.
But I do think like some of those scenes work, right? Like when I'm with Littlefinger and there are several of his employees, let's say, going at it in the background, I'm not just supposed to be titillated by that. I'm also learning things about this guy, right?
Yeah, right.
And I think they do that pretty effectively in what is essentially the Lee Pace burlesque show in the beginning of this episode. I think it's more than that. I think there's, like you said, there's so much that they're doing in that scene. And that's the thing that I'm coming to appreciate about this show, having seen this episode, having seen another one after it. I'm not going to talk about any of that stuff, but
right.
I think the show is creating this, like I said before, this tapestry, this like mural, a collage almost of things that it's doing. And you, any one piece you can look at and say, I'm not certain that I get everything it's doing here. But when looked at as a whole, I think it's pretty brilliantly telling this story.
Yeah, I think so too. One thing that I think people might be concerned is that we've watched ahead a little bit, which we don't normally do.
Mm-hmm.
But the way I took measures to keep that from informing, so I could still kind of like speculate, is at the end of every episode, I sat down with my notes and I wrote, before I watched the other one, what are the open questions I had? What are the things I thought were going to happen before I saw the next episode? So I can still preserve those thoughts without like, well, what actually happened? And I did that for all four of these episodes, and I'm not planning on watching ahead more. Like, I just wanted to get the kind of a good, you know, introduction and get an idea of what the season is going to look like. So it should be business as usual. Like, we've watched a little bit ahead at the in the early going. You've only seen, I think, two episodes. I've seen four. So we'll catch up pretty quick and it won't be a problem. But like, we've also put some guardrails on ourselves to keep any of that knowledge from leaking, as we don't want to spoil anybody. And I'm pretty confident that we won't.
I just made a clone copy of myself before I started that second episode.
Right.
And now I can't be sure of this because we're clones, but I think he's the one doing this podcast. So he might not have any memory of the second episode.
And if he gets out of line, I'm going to trap him in a glass tesseract of his emotions.
Okay.
Where he'll have to figure out how to cast four-dimensional shadows before he can get out. So it's going to be fine is what I'm saying. It's going to be fine.
Yeah. We'll get through this.
Since this is a cold openless episode, did you notice any differences in the credits?
I did. Yeah, there is a few things changed. It's very similar in its overall structure, but some of the objects in the scenes are changed. There is a very conspicuous Harry in there where there was not before. He's kind of the winged angel in that scene.
Yeah.
And you see the Cleon's dynasty eroding instead of building, which I thought was super cool.
And like decaying.
Their images are kind of coming apart instead of building with the dust.
And we meet this queen of Dominion.
Mm-hmm.
I think she was featured prominently in some of the like the statuary and some of the chroma pigments that they were using. But I also am I crazy that one of those statues was Dimmerzel?
Oh, it's possible.
It's tough because, like, you know, these are like living sand sculptures are wiggling around. But I was like, I wonder, because, you know, something we kind of got the impression from last season is like Dimmerzel is the true thing that is maintaining the integrity of the Empire. Like, she's the one that if Dusk is going to be like, you know what, I'm actually not ready to die, she shoves him into the particle beam. She's the one where when Day gets wobbly about his younger sibling, she's ready to snap a neck to maintain genetic purity. Yeah. She's the guardrails on the Empire itself. So like, he has a large illusion of being able to do choices and stuff, but any of these individuals deviate from what Cleon the First wanted, she seems to be quick to jerk her tail. So it's like, it wouldn't be crazy for me to think that like at some point in the story that Dimmerzel could become the Empire.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea if that's what they're going with that, because it doesn't seem like that jives with my memories of the book. But like, clearly they're playing a lot of jazz with the original material.
Yeah, and I have a lot of open questions about Dimmerzel, especially after this episode, with the way that Brother Day is acting. But it would make sense for her to have some place in that opening sequence. She might even be that broken face, because there's one face that's kind of like broken and torn, like her face kind of gets. And
we definitely seen that happen a couple of times, but I thought that was like the decay of the Cleons, the turning into something monstrous. But yeah, it could also be a representation of her fractured psyche revealing herself and her torn face. Yeah.
We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause. Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Our coverage of Hot D, Fire and Blood, and the 1980s Shogun miniseries continues. But then on Tuesday, for the first time in 35 years, we asked a question. Who framed Roger Rabbit? Hop aboard the train to Toontown as we revisit this incredible blending of live action and animation to see if it still holds up all this time later.
Then on Wednesday, we get our first look at Blake Crouch's mind-bending sci-fi series, Dark Matter. The first two episodes drop simultaneously on Apple TV+, and we'll have a pair of podcasts quantumly linked ready for you to observe.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live. And now, back with more Bald Move. All right, let's jump into the recap then.
Yep.
We start off with Harry. He's in some kind of black void. He's losing his shit. He's apparently mad at Gale and himself and just everyone. He's yelling and screaming.
He's just swinging wildly between these grandiose statements and this recriminations about why he can't trust people with his plan. And, you know, if he did, people could have helped them instead of. But then also being furious at Gale for being impetuous and an upstart. And Gale's voiceover, the any man can be a success. It takes a madman to be great.
Hmm.
Is whatever is happening to Harry is like. The show kind of hints, it's not even a subtext, it's text, that this is something that he had to go through to become, you know, for this, maybe this just particular part of his consciousness, this copy, to be complete. Because we knew last year that something went wrong in the transfer process. Mm-hmm. It wasn't as clean as Harry had helped, or had hoped that knife would synchronize his mental state, and there was some corruption. It seems like the show's telling me that whatever he's going through here in terms of like understanding fourth dimensional space in his own mind is something he had to do to be able to play the role he wanted to play in the Foundation. Do you get that too?
Huh. No, I wasn't getting that. Cause the other thing that he also, that we know for sure is that we're off his plan now, right? Like we see that literally
on the Prime Radiant itself tells us. Yeah. And Gale, in case you missed it, Gale as an expert in the Prime Radiant, is there to tell us what these symbols mean. So bad things.
Yeah, so it's possible that both things are true, right? They've gone off his plan, but that his plan was never good in the first place, and that actually prevent some kind of permanent fall to a dark age, he does need to go through this. But
yeah,
that's not necessarily
like it, because in the books it always felt like Harry was ultimately in control.
Yeah.
And I like the fact that like all these cryo sleeps and time jumps have made it feel like, as a viewer, that they are on a back foot, like maybe even a season long back foot, that they're going to be trying to come from behind rather than Harry striding confidently out of the vault and being like, here's how you fix this crisis. And and not the right pieces are not in the right place. The right players and don't have the right pieces in their hands. It's a real mess in this opening episode.
Yeah, certainly seems so. I think Gale and Salvor get acquainted as mother and daughter. We kind of had the beginning of this conversation in the finale of last season. They're going to get a little more into it here.
Kind of, like I said, this is the one thing that kind of took me aback is just how poor their chemistry is. Like Gale, and it's a lot if I put myself in her shoes. She wakes up. No, she doesn't wake up. She wakes up this other person who claims to be her daughter and has got all these questions for her and wants to have all these things in common for her. And it's overwhelming and off-putting. And Salver, for her credit, because she is, you know, has some intuition, intuitive touch here, backs off and is like, well, let's, you know, instead of we start talking with the big pictures, the big grand scope of what we're doing here, let's just get to know each other's people, which seems to maybe help a little bit.
And here's where it started to really strike me how good the show looks. And I want to shout out Apple for providing this level of quality screener, because a lot of networks don't.
Yeah,
and I think it really suffers. Like watching the Picard screeners at times was a pain. It was torturous. Apple is nailing it. Apple cares about what the press and the critics think of their content, apparently, because man, just the contrast is amazing. The black levels in this are just top notch. And the limited use of color in this like inky black scene would be totally wasted on a really shitty screeners.com copy or whatever. So kudos to them, because I was already impressed by the visuals, and they just get better as we go.
They really do.
We've got a voiceover then from Gale talking about waters rising and territory shrinking, and she applies that to what is happening here on Empire. Trantor. And then we get Brother Day having sex with Demerzel when assassins attack. He manages to fight them off, but he and Demerzel are wounded in the process. Then Demerzel takes him to the medical facility and heals him, then goes off to mend herself.
It was wild how Cleon went from fucking the shit out of Demerzel to using her as a human shield. Like that scene where like you see the guy, he just grabs, it's almost like something out of like a parody movie, the way he just callously grabs her and her head is sheared off and
and then tosses her at the assassin.
And I suspect it's like, well, she's not gonna be out of the fight because she's a robot, but she was out of the fight long enough that I'm almost like, oh fuck, Demerzel's kind of fucked, when then you see her fist just come out through that dude's chest and like, ah. And there's so many things, interesting things. Number one, maybe the thing that Goyer was talking about leaning into is just getting this tall, striking demigod to be naked for more of his show, because people dug that last year. It's like, Lee Pace wearing 90% of the clothes we see him in. Nothing wrong with that. But this version of Cleon, we talk about that degeneracy, that base thing, is that he is doing something that seems that the other clones think is taboo, having sex with Demerzel. But he's also like, it seems like he's having some difficulties with it. Like he needs a very particular thing that she gives him, and he doesn't like it when she tries to be a sex cat. But also there was something animal in him that truly enjoyed the violence.
Oh yeah.
Like
he enjoyed that fight.
He says later to Brother Dawn that he was terrified, but that feral smile he gave when he was in between dispatching assassins says that, like, secretly also, yes, I get to feel something.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which, and a lot different than the cooler. I mean, not that any of the empires were like really cool. They were pretty red hot, but like, you know, just in there, in the terms of the appetites, I think you're already seeing a change.
Yeah. And that enjoyment, I guess, of this fight goes away when he realizes that his aura is not going to protect him. I think that's where he talks about feeling the fear.
You know what? That's exact. He was enjoying it when he thought he was invincible, because it's a romp. You know, who wouldn't enjoy, you know, beating the shit out of people that are trying to kill you when you're invincible, right?
Yeah,
like that Rick absolutely. And Morty when he's gives the suit to him. He's like, you know, it's like, hey, we're killing all these guys, but it's like morally neutral because, you know, they're trying to kill us. It's a lot of fun, but yeah, then he takes a shot and it's like, ah, fuck.
Which is interesting. I've not seen anything. I thought there were ways to penetrate this aura, but I didn't think projectiles were going to get the job done. They do.
Well, it seems like it's been, I mean, Day thinks it's been tampered with, so seems like it's pretty good evidence.
Plenty of things have been tampered with in the Empire.
It's true.
Including Cleon themselves.
There's technical drift in these bracelets that they're no longer as effective. You know, this is not nearly as grandiose as some of the visuals, but Demerzel walking around with half a head, and then selling Laura Brynn just grabbing Lee Pace and effortlessly, like, I don't know how they pulled all that off, but
yeah, what
the
kind
interior of her face, her head, and like the blue blood running down, it was a striking image. Her just flopping Cleon into this you know, repair pool. And the one thing that I and no screener sites I know of have this, but like I wish we had subtitles, because I really tried to get the techno babble that they were going with here, where she says he had some kind of nanotoxic injection and there's 12 seconds before he delaminates into brazen death. I'm not sure exactly what she said, but her performance, where she's like, half of it is probably a prosthetics and effects and digital work, but like her kind of jittery, stuttery performance, I think, is a lot of Brynn. And she just really nails, like, when from Demerzel being at her most human to her most artificial, she's very able to inhabit that character. She's got nailed.
Yeah, one thing we didn't talk about, to go back to the visuals for a second, is the way they're telling a story with the visuals. That's kind of in opposition, or the microcosm here is Empire is expanding, because now you see Trantor. Last season it had that space elevator that got blown up and created that, you know, gash across the planet. This season it's got a bunch of rings that weren't there last season. Mm-hmm. And so it looks like Trantor and Empire are doing just fine, right? They're expanding. They've got people living out on those things, apparently, or working out there. It's a whole civilization on those rings. And at the same time, you've got Gale with the voiceover saying, and planets are being nibbled away on the edges of Empire, right? So the core might be strong here, and they might be projecting power with their image. But what's really happening is they're losing ground.
Yeah. And it's like they even talk openly by the end of this episode, when the brothers discussing their plight. Day says, we have to investigate the branches to see if the rots contain there, if it goes to the trunk or the root. So, yes. And that's the big textual thing, that the Empire is like, you know, puffing themselves up like a frilled lizard, like a cobra's hood.
Yeah.
But it's animals that do that, they're not puffed. You never say an animal, like, you don't say a grizzly bear puffs itself up. Grizzly bear just like rolls on in and tears your head off. It doesn't have to puff itself up or make it look self larger, because it's impressive and deadly. Animals that have to puff themselves up to look larger is because they're trying to intimidate a larger, more impressive threat. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's emphasis on looks. It looks bigger and more bustling and poppy, but like they're actually losing that rising floodwater is taking away their territory. And I love them exploring the contradictions of that.
All right, let's go over to Harry, who is now in another strange place. This time it's some glass prison, a bunch of triangles. With the help of a memory of his younger self, he realizes that he's in a four-dimensional space and uses his new perspective to escape to a larger strange place.
Mm-hmm.
And there he's going to meet his life mate, Yarna, who he realizes isn't who she appears to be, and she says, well, work out who I am then. Use your brain. This is a really interesting visual way to portray the mind bending itself, I think.
Yes.
Creating these dimensional spaces, allowing him to kind of explore the environment, which is really his own mind in this case. I take it the prime radiant is not the thing that he's escaping. It's his mind. Broken nature of his mind.
But I also think I buy the fact that, like, you know, this Prime Radiant designed to be this kind of like multidimensional Rubik's Cube, that like your brain inhabiting that substrate instead of your own brain or something that's designed to mimic your human consciousness would also be a fucking trip. And I the way that they visualize, because like, who the hell knows? Like, I've heard it many times explained of like, you know, what it would be like a two-dimensional being to see a sphere go through your plane of existence. And it's like, as much as I love the physicists that are trying to help my caveman brain understand these things, I just can't do it. It's like, it's trying to like think about living forever, you know, like at some point you can't. But I really appreciate them with these unreal geometries, like that scene of Harry Seldon like descending a staircase, and the camera pans past him, and without ever breaking continuity, suddenly he's ascending, and the gravity has changed, and I have no idea what kind of complicated staircase green screen thing they did to pull, like maybe some rotating sets, but it's super cool. All that gravity-defying stuff looked really fucking cool. And it sells it on an intuitive thing that, like, this guy is trying to navigate these unreal topographies and it bending his human frame of reference.
For sure. And I think the other important thing that they're doing, the thing that really gives you the context you need to just kind of sit back, relax, say, okay, I'm going to let this fourth-dimensional thing be what it is the flashback. Him experimenting with shadow and the dimensionality of a shadow being only two dimensions, whereas the object that's casting it is three dimensions. And I think that gives me personally license to say, okay, I might not be able to puzzle out exactly how all of this stuff works,
right?
But that concept is real, and so I'm just going to go with it.
Yeah, and it reinforces also what we're told later, that like ever since he's a little boy, he's been asking questions that nobody else and the people have told him to not do it, and it's a waste of time. And you see his father, like, you know, instead of being like, wow, my son is intuitively understanding these multidimensional things and how they cast shadows on the other, and he's like, yeah, I bought that book and you're disrespecting it. So he's been told his entire life to stop fucking around with this stuff, and
by his father, his mother seems to encourage it. So
yeah.
There were
two
dueling forces there. Let's move on because we'll come back to this here in a bit. Look, sometimes a cut is just a cut, but in this scene, the cut was very obvious, and I kind of figured out where we were from this cut context. They cut straight to the Prime Radiant sitting prominently in the foreground of the scene. And I figured at this point that Harry was probably in that Prime Radiant. Gale's having, like, laying on this raft, having this nightmare about some guy with goggles and a fire chasing her. I don't know. It's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And she wakes up to find that Salvor is missing. She goes underwater to look for her, but she was just out fishing. And then Gale tells her about these visions that she's been having of the future. And Salvor tells her, well, oh, that's interesting, because I've been having visions of your past. And she wants to know why Gale hasn't activated the Prime Radiant. Doesn't believe her made-up excuse.
She's got her lie detector.
Mm-hmm.
And Gale is lying through her teeth. She is. Yeah. She's jailed an evil genie inside his bottle, and he's probably getting pissed about it.
Yeah.
So she's correctly surmising that it'd be bad news to bring Harry out right now.
Mm-hmm. I don't know what these visions are all about necessarily. This is something to establish that I think we should look forward to for the rest of the season, right?
Yeah, it's like it's one of the things where I had some ideas what it could be depicting, but honestly, you know, because like how far in the future is she looking forward to, and how closely are they going to mirror what the Foundation and is going to do and from the books to, so it's like it's but clearly she is foretelling. It seems like she's seeing another potential crisis point that has her worried.
Yeah.
She like maybe an ultimate scares. Like the when you know you used to play video games and you could fuck up enough that you get the bad ending.
Uh-huh.
You know, you couldn't win anymore, you would just get like the bad ending. It's like I think that she's foreseeing like some sort of like bad ending for the whole Foundation project.
Yeah, I think you're right, and I expect, much like we were kind of exploring Salvor's visions in the first season, that this will be a season-long arc for her, like trying to understand these visions and understand how to respond to them. Then a siren goes off on Terminus and the vault is activated. It doesn't open for 20 minutes. People are getting impatient. So the warden and director and some other people decide to go out there, and they think that Harry's giving them time to prepare for war with the Empire. And so they start, even though they're pretty unprepared, according to the person who manages their armies, I guess.
Yeah, and this like this goes back to like, you know, we remember that the warden never was taken as seriously as they wanted to be on Foundation. Seems historically that's an issue. Mm-hmm. But like this director is looking forward to a war with the Empire. He's like, I dare say we're ready for anything that Harry Seldon will throw at us. And then you contrast that with Gale freaking out about all the 1,000 crises on the Red Path. And it's like, oh, you don't know what the hell you're talking about.
Yeah. But it makes a lot of sense for these people to be sort of itching for a fight, right? I think didn't Harry come out of the vault and say, like, we're going to have to go to war eventually with the Empire?
Yeah, inevitable. So, like, that's something that they, like, and it's almost like their prophet says it's inevitable, and you know, it kind of implies that you're going to win.
Absolutely, yeah.
So like you have to
just get wiped off the map.
Yeah, oh, it's inevitable we're going to fight the Empire, and of course they'll kick our ass in and this whole thing will be a disaster, but you know, the important thing is we fight. So they have, as you can tell, that he has expectation, and you know, also the way we saw the hero worship already starting with Seldon, and large, one of the reasons he executes himself is so that he can put a little brakes on that, but they're already calling him a prophet.
Mm-hmm.
I also really appreciate the shows just giving us like the years, so I don't have to go back and through Wikipedia articles and add up everything. It's been 173 years since Empire exiled the Foundation of Terminus, and it's been 138 years since the last time the vault opened on Terminus. So I like that they give us, you know, if time's going to be a character, it's nice to see their face every once in a while and get them fingerprinted.
138 years since anyone's heard this siren, implying they don't ever do vault drills. They don't ever test the system. Like, they're hoping that 138 years later, this alarm's going to go off.
Yeah, you'd think that Harry would do a test of the emergency vault system.
Yeah, once
a
year.
Like, yeah,
I gotta go get my prostate probed more often than they got to test their alarm system. That doesn't seem fair.
Yeah.
Anyway, and I kind of like this refresh of the cast. You know, I was kind of liking this warden. So I think
very
that scary could be,
looking dude.
Yeah, he seems like simultaneously intimidating, but also like just a big softy.
I didn't have time to look him up, but he reminded me of one of the captains of the later Matrix series. Yeah, captains of the whatever their hover ships are. I don't know if it's the same guy, because like surely he doesn't look like he's aged in 20 years if he is, but maybe he's one of those guys that like looks 35 when he's 35 and 35 when he's 55. But he had that same kind of sturdy, commanding presence. And the governor, the administrator, he's just obviously a
He's got like sniveling Death Star lieutenant, you know, Captain Nita type that energy.
If I'm supposed to like him, the show's got an uphill battle, because I kind of like the warden. I kind of don't like the administrator. He seems like a weasel, an overconfident weasel at that.
Yeah, the warden's got big like Ron Perlman energy. Like, yeah, like he's kind of a bad guy, but he's not he's not gonna be a bad guy unless you are a bad guy to him, you know.
Yeah, he's a galoot and they can be good or bad.
Yeah, big old galoot. Then Harry talks with I want to say it's Yarna. It's tough with British accents with no subtitles and names I'm not familiar with.
What I wrote down was Eleanor, Helena.
Oh no,
Elena. And you wrote down Yarna, and I'm like, that, because guys, there's a couple times when he rapidly says a bunch of names was in his episode where I'm like, I'm not entirely sure.
Okay, just know it's his life mate, right?
His life mate, his foundation wife.
Yeah. He's talking with her, but he realizes quickly that she's speaking in some mathematically constructed Dr. Seuss rhyming structures.
It's the meter, you know, like when you hear about Shakespeare got the iambic pentameter. You know, it's a rhythm to the speech, and
this is like
hear it when she says the step by step 1 2 3 QED. Like there's like this kind of like rhythm, and in universe, it's a particular type that's only known to this one, or like it's made famous by this one particular mathematician. And unless you have a really good recall of season one, you might have forgotten that Gail Dornick uses this this math that was created by this Calais to solve the Abraxas conjecture, and that's what got Harry Seldon's notice of Gale in the first place. And he used a lot of her formulas in his pioneering work of psychohistory. So again, he's having to solve some puzzles of his own making to kind of understand where he is and the nature of his reality. I thought that was cool.
Yeah, and he deciphers that he must be in the Prime Radiant, and yes, he is. We'll get to kind of the explanation of that here in a bit.
Yeah.
But yeah, I thought it was cool too. Like all these little hurdles for him to jump mentally so that he can kind of piece his mind back together enough to be reasonable.
We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
And now, back with more Bald Move.
If you're still hazy on it, you might recall that Harry gave Gale a gift of an original work of this ninth proof of folding from this Calais as a present. You know, he took it out of the archives because the empire is going to get destroyed anyway. So it's something that's that links him and Gale together, like mm-hmm. like intrinsically, and at a time when they're pulled apart by the plot, you know, and by the fact that she doesn't trust him, he's being reminded that there is a connection there that is interwoven into his pet project. And I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah. And then, like I said, we find out almost immediately that yes, in fact, he is in the Prime Radiant, because Gale tells Salvor that she moved him there. And there's two of him because he's also in the vault, as we know, which surprises Gale. And then Salvor talks Gale into opening the Prime Radiant, and Gale sort of explains that there is another crisis coming and they are off of Harry's original plan. So it's extra dangerous with all these crises.
Yeah.
Then they might be approaching an age of darkness that never ends.
So Harry's made things worse effectively, mm-hmm. you know,
and she has too. Gale, like, not true. Following the plan. Like, she's got some culpability here.
Yeah. I think it's really entertaining how differently they see Harry. Like, Gale sees Harry as this flawed, mm-hmm. maniacal, perhaps evil, malignant presence that manipulates people and lies to you, whereas Salvor sees him as just like he is the foundation. He is the guy. He's the guy that shows up and gives you a pep talk and tells you everything's going to be okay, and here's where you can find the battleship you need. And mm-hmm. They have completely radically different conceptions of Harry. And also, you know, Gale knew the real Harry. Salvor knew the Harry that he meant to manifest itself at the foundation. And then they both are going to get to know this fragmented, insane, incomplete copy of Harry. And mm-hmm. those are three distinct versions of him. I think that's kind of mm-hmm. cool to see how they play with that. And I was wondering throughout this early going, is like, are we ever going to see the Harrys converge? Seems like they have to. That's such a delicious opportunity to see, you know, rough and tumble, got myself out of fourth dimensional jail Harry go against, I reconstituted this vault from the atoms of my corpse Harry.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and I do wonder how much you can trust Harry at this point, regardless of his intentions. We're already off his plan. And you've got a compromised version of Harry here inside the Prime mm-hmm. Radiant. But that compromised version of Harry was intended to keep the foundation on track, right? Mm-hmm. He's intended as a contingency plan or a guiding force overall. If that is broken and the original foundation was never intended to be the foundation, then how do we know that any of this is going to work out? It's extra scary.
Well, it's one of the fun things about the show and the series is like, is this reversal really a reversal, or did Harry intend it to happen? Did it have to happen this way so that the plan,
right?
You know, because again, we learned the one iron law of psychohistory is it doesn't work on individuals.
Mm-hmm. Or in short timelines.
Did he like sow some controllable and foreseeable chaos to make sure his overall objectives or are these things truly sliding out of his control?
Yeah.
The Prime Radiant seems to think that's the case.
Mm-hmm. I'm waiting for the third backup of Harry to be revealed. The one that was intended to control, the one that went psychotic, and the one that's in the vault.
It honestly wouldn't surprise me if there's multiple Harrys by the time, like many more Harrys, like three, four, five run around.
Let's get a dozen. A full Baker's dozen.
At least three empires. You need at least three Harrys to go against three empires.
True. All right, Empire is healed, but he's really paranoid. He has his Shadow Master killed for not stopping the assassin attack. And apparently no one has any idea who hired these assassins or let them in. So Day wants to scan Dawn and Dusk's memories to make sure that they weren't the ones who hired the assassins. Not trusting anybody.
Mm-hmm.
The beginning of the scene with him getting healed is really funny. I loved it.
Yeah, Lee's having a lot of fun with the Empire being so paranoid about being decanted that he doesn't want them to put him asleep so they can work on him. So he's
right.
like
he might
fully
never wake
conscious.
Up.
And it looks like hell. Like they're ripping off this mesh from his skin. There's this fleet of like nanite leeches furrowing his body. And it's like it does look like it's torture.
And boy, he's portraying torture. He's going for it, man.
Yeah, he's screaming. And like I like how he's like in the middle of a sentence and then somebody rips something off of him and that gets incorporated into his performance. And he gets up. So I'm wearing a robe. I'm sitting there with my manhood flapping around.
the wink at the younger at that Don. What is he winking about? Like Don has everything you got, man.
He's trying to be cool, like trying to look cool in front of Don, because he's also trying to politic his brothers, because his brothers don't agree with this plan that he's trying to do. And like, you know, Dusk is a lot more stodgy about it. And Don seems like, actually, I don't even know if Don, what he thinks about it.
Yeah, he's pretty reserved in his opinions. We get a taste of it. He's less than thrilled about this marriage thing. I think that's one thing we can say for sure. But like,
well, that makes perfect sense that like, Day marries somebody and starts having children. That essentially cuts Dusk and Day out of the whole situation. It's the end of the clone dynasty, the way I see it.
And that might be fine for more fine for Dusk, who's already had his day in the sun.
Yeah,
he's still philosophically very opposed to it. But Dawn has something to lose here, right? Dawn is supposed to be the next day. So
yeah, he's never going to experience that. He's never going to be the man. So what is he
17 of you have existed and had this experience, and you're going to cut it off now, moments before I get to experience it? No, come on.
I like how they strategically had Lee Pace's robe to where it just covered his navel, so they didn't have to do any silly putty in the navel. Business. I liked it. But we know there's no belly button behind there.
Yeah. It's true.
This is where we learn that you know, to get us grounded in time, that they refer to the Klingon the 13th, which is the Klingon that we knew. And we also interesting. What'd you say?
I was going to say just the fear that he felt. That's the reference there.
Oh, yeah, the fear he felt. But the thing I thought was interesting, you mentioned that Harry Seldon in the credit sequence is prominently shown with angel wings. Extremely interesting that these guys are referred to as blind angels. With that symbology in the credit sequence. Now, this isn't any book knowledge, because like I said, I was in junior high the last time I read these things, and I don't remember anything about these blind angels, but I thought that was... You know, if I'm looking for connections and some theory crafting, that's a direction I'm going to be leaning in. It's also really cool that these people literally don't have eyes. How do you fight? I thought that was just like kind of cool science fiction fantasy kind of pulpy thing. But yeah, and then they also talk about, you know, Klingon the day saying that I feel like a singular soul. Don't you feel like a singular soul? And then being kind of
interesting.
Philosophical about, you know, are we a continuum? Are we an individual? Like this is like heresy from last season. And they're just, it's cool. And Dawn coming back and being like, look, you getting married and having kids, you know, that's not immortality. That's the end of us.
Yes. I think all of this raises like such huge, fascinating questions for Empire. Because of the intricacies of their relationships with each other and with Demerzel and with the power that they wield, how is Demerzel going to feel about all this? Because if she is the guide rails of the Empire, she probably has the final word on this. She's actively courting a relationship with Day that is sexual and certainly emotional in nature, at least for Day. And Day at the same time is looking to get married, to tear down the Kleonic dynasty in the way it's been known before, and perhaps betray her on an emotional level. And I don't know how she's going to react to that.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's really interesting because Demerzel's the one that all of the Kleons trust implicitly. But we also know she's the one that has like at the ultimate, because like we talked about this last season, she's so powerful. There's nothing that the Kleons could do to protect themselves from her. Like if she just wanted to go rogue and kill one of them, snapped her neck, whatever, there's nothing they could do till it's all over. And they like, you know, but she's also this position of trust. So she's,
yeah.
And that's, I do wonder if they'll get to a point where, you know, some of the other Kleons had jealousies and suspicions of whether she would be loyal to Empire versus, and she always proved herself, you know, loyal to their word. But also there's the hint that like she is working on a bigger plan. You know, she's mm-hmm. been alive for 11,000 plus years. She knew the original Kleon. She knew what came before Kleon. Maybe she's got some ideas of what she thinks should happen afterwards to Kleon. I'm looking to see some of that suspicion turn to her direction. If any of the brothers are going to start suspecting sure. her, and what would that look like if they don't trust Dimmerzel?
Yeah, no, it's a very interesting question. I think the other big thing here is philosophically is this idea that the dynasty is already compromised mm-hmm. and we are no longer perfect clones. We are drifting apart from our source. And I'm going to solve that by steering into the rapids, as Dusk will later say. Is that a valid way forward? I mean, look, they're telling the story of the fall of the Empire. So obviously this is not going to work out long term, I don't think.
No, I'm pretty sure marriage is going to solve it. He's this guy. Harry didn't see that one coming.
but I find it interesting to consider, at least in the moment, is this going to be a contributing factor to the downfall of Empire, or is it going to be something else that ultimately does it? And maybe this is a course correct that needs to happen and strengthens the Empire in the short term.
Yeah, and it's funny to get caught up in that too, because I do too, because I'm kind of rooting for the Empire because I think they're cool and neat, even though it's
conceptually clear.
But it's funny to get caught up in the like, oh, I wonder if this will be the thing that saves them, when obviously, unless Harry's just wrong next season, like, we're calling off the Dark Ages, turns out Empire's got it. Everything. And but it's also something I think a lot of people can relate. If you had enough life experience, surely there's been a time where you have been in a swirling around the drain scenario with a company or a relationship, and the question is, should I do something radical right now to change the game, or should I still circle, because that's going to give me time to think about something better? Like
what you're doing is not working, right?
Yeah. But also what you're proposing might, like, if it doesn't work, you're going to die right away.
Yeah.
Is that better than biding more time to figure out another answer? Or is it better to take the resources you have now and act right now? And it's like, that's, no one will ever fucking knows, because it's a die is cast situation. You know,
you either try something radical or you don't, and you can never know what the alternative outcome would
be. I'm usually on team try something radical than circle the drain one more time, but
it's very startup philosophy of you
when you're playing with the lives of trillions and the whole galaxy.
So Brother Day goes to see how Dimmerzel is holding up, kind of at the end of this scene here. She's reconstructing her head, so she says she'll be all right, but she's not great at the moment. We find out here that she has a decentralized consciousness, which I thought was interesting. I was questioning, you know, where is her CPU? Where is
my
vital function?
Is how decentralized? Like, so decentralized that if he took a particle beam and just incinerated you, you would survive? Or decentralized and like you can have your whole head cut off and your big toe is enough? That, like, how decentralized are we really talking here?
Yeah.
Because if she's decentralized to the point that Kleon is, it's entirely possible that there's multiple Dimmerzels running around.
Oh, I hadn't thought about that.
Because that's the thing, is like that. I don't wonder if they'll ever play with that idea, the fact that you could decant the Kleon without another one dying. You could have multiple Brother Days running around. And we did have that one where you had the rebels that infiltrated and gotten their hands on the genetic copy, and they'd made a copy of Dawn.
Yeah.
When she said decentralized, I'm like, yeah, how decentralized are we talking about?
Cloud backup, you know?
Exactly. So we're talking some Battlestar Galactica type. You die here and you wake up on the base ship, or what are we talking about here?
Interesting. Yeah, we'll see if that factors in later.
The other thing I thought is curious is, I interpreted when he says, is what we're doing indecent. And she says, oh, Empire, any gift given freely out of love is never indecent. That's not an answer.
It's a platitude.
She is answering it with a hypothetical example. She didn't say I gave. She's just making an observation. Mm. If something's given freely of love, it can't be indecent. But with what we know of Demerzel's programming,
is that actually what happened?
Does she have free will when it comes to Empire's commands, at least in certain? Yeah, I just thought that was really interesting, especially in conjunction with something else Empire's going to say at the end of this episode. And also, yeah, the effect of her just reweaving her head with this beam, it's like, it's one of those things where it's magic, but it's so fucking cool. And it's one of those things that makes me think that, yes, a starship could be at the bottom of an ocean for 130 years in this galaxy, and you could flip a switch and it would fix itself, because the shit's just that good, man.
Yeah. Indistinguishable from magic. A ship makes its way down to Trantor, and a woman we will come to know as Queen Sereth prepares herself to meet with Empire. My God, man, look at this mothership that this shuttle launches from. It's gorgeous.
This is the jump ship of sequence of last season, where I'm just like, what the fuck? Oh, is this like a chandelier, a jellyfish, a spaceship? There's a solar sail coming out of it. And then you see these rings, and each ring looks like a ring world, like a halo type of thing that had like, you start to get the size of the structures and the population that might be on that. And it's just like, yeah, it's just a 30 seconds of just your mind being blown. And
it happens every 25 minutes in this show. It is a relentless, unmatched, relentless images of unmatched sci-fi beauty in this show. I cannot stress enough how good this looks.
This is beauty, because this is not like seeing the X-Wing fly down the Death Star trench, which is very cool.
Yeah.
But it wasn't beautiful. In fact, Ralph McQuarrie is intentionally not being beautiful. This is hardware.
Mm-hmm.
Going down to kill other hardware, and but this is like, you know, in the era of Empire, still in its diminished state, the amount of beauty and aesthetic and projection that they're able to do with their it's not just cool, it's also just beautiful.
Yeah,
gorgeous.
Is it cringe yet to say chef's kiss? Because it's what it is. And I thought it was impressive that they put these rings up in the last 138 years. I guess it's a long time for a civilization that can mend your head with a magic wand, but
true.
You know, it feels pretty grandiose to me.
Yeah. But also, it's funny that they, so like internally, we have this woman talking to the queen, and she says that she's visited Trantor before, you know, long time ago, and they were just building the rings, and they had these signs up where they're saying that the rings of Trantor are like the frill around the neck of a lizard, a sign of strength and aggression. And I guess I wish I saw this lizard in real life, because I think of the lizard that does this in real life, and it's just a little scrawny little, you know, it's the fish that runs across. It's not super impressive. Like, if it was a Komodo dragon that did that shit. But like, is that kind of like secret patheticness part of it? Or are we supposed to understand that there is like this fearsome lizard indigenous to Trantor that is strong and impressive?
Yeah, I guess that's my question. Why would Empire themselves refer to it as the lizard? Don't they see the defense mechanism symbolism inherent in
like
that?
Our rings are like the puffer fish. We are actually weak and small, but we like to swallow a bunch of water.
Right. But we hope like you'll think of us as
lost
big and
the
powerful.
Plot a bit. Yeah,
totally. And she rightly points that out. So how that became, maybe that was the way the people talked about it.
Hmm. But she mentions, I thought she said it's like there's maybe the posters are like protesters putting it up or something. But
maybe that would make a little more sense. I guess, like, you know, what are the odds here? Because there's going to be some question later from Dusk about like, why would she try and kill you if she wasn't married to you yet and she stood a chance of gaining everything before she did? Makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. Are there any odds here that Sereth tried to have Day killed? It would make a lot more sense if it was someone
it's
who wanted to prevent
the
marriage.
You'd be a fool not to suspect it, because the show is telling you to.
She seems real iffy. I don't think I would trust this person.
Well, especially since I got a clear from this first episode, like her and the relationship with this retainer woman.
Mm-hmm.
Rue. Very much felt to me like Marjorie Tyrell and the Queen of Thorns rolling into King's Landing.
Yep.
Like, these are people...
They should be afraid of you. That's what
she says. Yeah, these are people that if you underestimate them, they are going to eat your lunch and slit your throat.
Mm-hmm.
And the dust...
An empire underestimates
everyone. This might have already happened. This might have been the person who scrapped to the top of their dominion.
Yes.
And architected the... And you've invited them into our home, you know, like this dangerous thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, if you're a Game of Thrones fan, you know that that's high praise to compare these two individuals, and it shows that they better watch a step. Uh-huh. Especially since she's full of piss and vinegar. Like, she humiliates Day in their meeting ritual.
Yeah, I want to talk about that when we get there, but it's kind of shocking what she's doing in that throne room scene. But let's get to Dusk and Day talking as she kind of lands here and her procession proceeds. Dusk chastises Day for the relationship that he has with Dimmerzel. Day, though, is more concerned with who tampered with his aura and how far they're drifting from their source genetics. And like I said, during this, the queen is arriving. The stuff that Dusk is saying here makes a lot more sense to me, especially after seeing Queen Sereth's demeanor and how squirrely she seems. I'm not sure why Day is so on board with this idea of marrying at all, let alone this person.
Desperation. I think what I'm hearing
is a midlife crisis.
he thinks that the empire is going to fall because of this genetic drift, and if we wait another generation, they're in a point of, like, I guess you're supposed to understand Dominion as the second largest power in the universe or the galaxy, right?
Seemingly,
and he's saying, and like, you think of like the mad shit she's talking in the throne room, like, you wait another generation and like, let's say that, like, we'll see what happens, and Day and Dawn might be the one that does the deed. In 30 years, the empire could crumble to the state that where, like, Dominion's like, fuck you, we're actually gonna carve you up. And so it's like, you know, the circling the drain thing. It's like, do you wait until you're in the drain before you try to do something desperate, like marry yourself to the second most powerful? And but, like, you know,
if all he wants is children, I guess it's the status that's important to him as well. The image, right, is still very important to him. He can't be seen to have children with someone less than his stature would require. Right.
And if the dynasty collapses and gets out, wouldn't it be better to have, like, to revert back to the form of governments that the universe is comfortable with, which, you know, until the Cleonic dynasty, you know, you had father and son, father and son, and sometimes it would fall and another thing would dynasty take place. But it's, you know, you're returning the universe, you're returning the galaxy to a form of government that it's familiar with before they find out that the rug's been pulled out from underneath them, you know?
So it'll seem like business as usual.
Because it does seem from the outside, this is a secret. No one really knows that the genetic drift is a thing. The Kleons are trying. It doesn't seem like the Dominion people have a good idea. They know that the Empire is weak and they smell blood in the water, but they're not sure why.
Yeah, it's more about the rumors of, like, planets in the Outer Reach not being so on board with the Empire, that kind of thing.
I want to say the one line that I thought was interesting coming from Day, where Dusk is taking him to task about betting Dimmerzel, and he says, well, she's the one that first initiated. I feel like that's something that every predator says. You know, like, if you ever watched A Catch a Predator, like, in this person's,
I mean,
come over to have sex with
years,
a 13-year-old,
and
he's like, oh, she's the one that came on to me. I was innocent, and then, you know, and how...
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, it could be that she did, but I'm taking her non-answer and his, like, you know, unconsidered, she's the one that initiated, actually, to be very suspicious about the nature of this being a gift freely given and what Demerzel actually thinks about it, and whether, you know, the fact that Day is saying, like, is this something we're doing bad? Like, he's got an opinion on it. He's wanting to be reassured that it's not. It seems like it's a bad idea all around.
I mean, let's take him at his word here and say that Demerzel made the first move. This could be a soft attempt at steering Empire back on track. Like, she sees that he's getting ideas about marrying and having children and making the dynasty that. Well, what if she can distract him from that with a relationship, both physical and emotional, and keep that dynasty, that clone dynasty going?
No, I think I said... there's certainly something going on here. I don't know what early goings, mm-hmm. but it's another fascinating piece to the Cleon Demerzel puzzle.
Yeah. Let's go over to Gale and Salvor, deciding that they need to get off the planet and that they can use Salvor's sunken ship to do it. It's dangerous, but there's a hurricane coming, which will kill them anyway if they don't do it. So they swim down, activate the ship, and then bond over being the last Anaxions. I don't know about you, but I always hold my breath during breath-holding scenes, underwater scenes in movies.
Yep, sure.
TV shows. Just to see. Just like, mm-hmm. I know there's editing trickery, and you can never tell how long they're actually under. I always try and hold it as long as they do. This is a realistic amount of time underwater. If you give that, like... Gale is born on this planet and she's basically a fish person and she can give another lung full to Salvor. Yeah, totally doable.
I went into the scene, arms crossed, eyes narrowed, because when they describe what they're about to do, I'm like, this seems like a lot of shit.
Mm-hmm.
I actually think they pulled it off, but I do think that they, and this is something I've seen a lot of, projects do, where they put the hero in an impossible situation, and instead of just them surviving, they have to make it exciting on top of that, you know. Mm-hmm. And I felt like and there's a lot of things about the scene I liked. I really liked how they had the two actors portraying, you know, you had Leah Harvey and what is the other? Lou LaBelle. Yeah, she's from a water planet and she's swimming like a mermaid, like undulating patterns, very smoothly gliding, effortlessly mm-hmm. swimming. And Salvor is like
doggy paddle.
Looks like she's had no idea what to do in water. Like her limbs are just jerking around. I think they fucked up by having Salvor actually drown.
Oh, like, you think so?
I mean, she passes out and closes her eyes and starts drifting.
Yes, like, I'll give you that.
If they got to where she was starting to like panic and then with her last breath, Gale gives it to her and then Gale passes out, I honestly think it would have played out a lot better. I don't know that I buy that Salvor is unfamiliar with the water, could drown. You could give a breath to her and then she recovers underwater enough to reboot it. It just seemed like, to me, I start laughing. I go beyond being concerned for their safety and be like, well, this is a step too far. If it was mm-hmm. me, I think I would have just had them do the plan, which is, you know, Gale is there as essentially a human scuba tank mm-hmm. and you already have to save her from drowning. You got the abyss scene there. It's like they did a double abyss and one of them was still underwater. And I was like, yeah, it's a lot.
And just make it apparent that Salvor is running out of air. She taps Gale on the shoulder. It's time. Yeah. Give me your air. And that would work a little better.
It's still a fucking wild, crazy, seat of your pants situation, but to have Salvor mm-hmm. partially drowned on top of it was one. Instead of increasing the tension, it bled at all. Because I'm like, well, there's obviously they're both going to live because this is, you know, but maybe I'm not supposed to think that. I don't know.
Yeah, it's supposed to be very dramatic.
Not a big deal. Certainly dramatic. Everything else I bought, like the fact that this ship can survive underwater for a long time and because mm-hmm. the tech is just that good, you know?
And I really like the scene at the end of this mm-hmm. where Gale lays it all out. Like, look, you came here with some knowledge that I don't have, some familiarity. Like, this is a parasocial relationship. Don't expect me to be as comfortable as you are with it. But let me extend this olive branch. We are now the mm-hmm. last Anaxians. We have that in common. And I think this is where I'm starting to feel like there's something there between them, or there could be, right? I think this is a really good emotionally fortifying scene.
Yeah, it's not just that there's not chemistry between the actors. It's like that's an intentional thing. And I actually really liked it when it's like Salvo reaches to Gale and like Gale jerks away from her, which must have been really painful.
Mm-hmm.
And again, they don't have this, but like, you know, I'm your daughter, you're my mom, and you're mm-hmm. recoiling from my touch. And Gale has got the presence of mind to like see that. And like you said, offer the olive branch to like.
And puts her hand like on her shoulder or leg or something at the end of the scene to.
The show
to say
that,
like that was a right. reaction I had, not necessarily a way I feel.
This is I am in permanent flight or flight response for the because from my perspective, the last 3 days I've had have been harrowing.
Yeah,
But yeah, like the last Synaxians, and even the joke about even if you don't swim like one, which that, again they I thought they illustrated beautifully in the physicality of the performances. I can see a potential for this to be a good traveling companion type roadshow deal.
Totally. Sereth goes before Empire. They're in the throne room and they trade gifts. Dusk absolutely loves Sereth's gift, but I would say is less thrilled with her demeanor. Fortunately, this meeting ends with Demerzel calling Empire away to tell them that they found a message from a long dead soldier, which claims that the Mega Flare didn't actually destroy Terminus or the Invictus. Demerzel says, I've heard rumors about an alliance at the edge of the galaxy, which claims that Harry Seldon is going to return and lead them into a new age. We should probably investigate. And they agrees.
Yeah, I thought, I always think it's interesting when you see these pomp and circumstances. I'm always trying to read the insult and, you know, like, mm-hmm. like judge, like on a point, like on a fight,
the transgressions of conduct here.
Did you think that it was an insult to offer her the bronze Trantor? Cause I felt like, and maybe she just had a truly extravagant gift, but like the gift that she gave them, which is this rare imperial pigment that's native to their planet, of this chroma pigments that the Dusk uses to do their elaborate dynastic murals. And like clearly mm-hmm. Day was like touched. Like, I mean, I'm sorry, Dusk was touched. Like he like yeah. greedily went and just like, I can't believe this is so like touched by the gift. And then he gives her something from like the gift shop from the Trantor Museum. And like, oh, Trantor. Huh. Yeah. Twins. Impressive. Was that calculated as a little of an insult of like, I don't need to impress you that much?
No, I don't think so. I think this is a miscalculation on his part as like an image thing. This is him saying that the gift here is not anything physical that I'm going to hand to you. The gift here is me agreeing to marry you. Me bringing you into the dynasty and the power of Empire.
You should be happy you're at the show.
And this is a representation of Empire. The seat of power of Empire, right? It's
the eye.
In Day's mind, this is saying what you are about to get is so much more valuable than any trinket you could ever receive.
Uh-huh.
And this is the token of it.
This is a tribute to the greatest gift you'll ever receive.
Right. It's not the actual gift itself.
But the way she turns it around, yes. Where, oh, well, surely you're offering me something larger than just Trantor, or is this a vision of your diminishing future that you're going to shrink to this just is all Trantor. You have? And like he was completely wrong footed from the rest of this conversation because he tries to mm-hmm. go with the rings and she's like, oh, well, you know, that's surely not as the most efficient way to launch cargo into space. And he's like, well, all Trump's efficiency. And she brings it right to overcompensating. And
here's what I don't understand. What is her deal? What is her game here? Because this is not the way to ingratiate yourself to someone like Empire, I wouldn't think.
I think this is she's like, I feel like that maybe they've waited too long and the Dominion thinks that this is maybe more of an even trade, or maybe that they're doing a fate. Because that's the thing that like going back to the Tyrells,
she's nagging him. So going back to
the Tyrells of Game of Thrones.
Uh huh.
I thought the Tyrells saw themselves doing the Lannisters a favor by marrying into the family because you guys are broke as hell. And yeah, you got to see the power. But we have all the money secretly, and we have all the food, and we have all the soldiers. So, like, while you have all the prestige, we're doing a trip, but like, don't you ever think that you're fucking better than us? And I think that's the energy that they're bringing into this with the Empire, where the Empire thinks that like, I'm still the Empire, and this is such a huge boon to them, where they're thinking, we wait another generation, we might be able to take it all by ourselves. That's what I thought was the thing.
Yeah, but
here,
to come out so overtly with that idea is, I think, a huge mistake on their part and a slap in the face prematurely. Like, the Tyrells don't come in swinging like that. The Tyrells lull you into a false sense of security and make you think that you're something big and special that they need until they have you, and then they flip the table.
But if that's not what she's doing, do anything to check her, then that kind of proves her point, because why wouldn't he? Like, I'm giving you this gross insult and you're taking it because...
Yeah, it's a risky test. I mean...
Because, like, what, are you going to kill me? Then we're at war. Do you not think you can win this war?
Mm-hmm.
And if you just, like, kick me off your planet and you disrespect me, and we're... Then it's like, I don't know. Like, there's, like... They both are coming to this table not knowing exactly what's under it. You know, does Day have the shit to back up his or not?
And I do think Empire is in a different position than they were last season, when you had the religious, the religious test of their power, right? Like, there were these potential usurpers coming in and saying, "Hey, we think we're better than you, and you've fallen from grace, and all this."
Or that you're an abomination, and our religious order will make sure everyone knows you're a demon. Yeah,
but they had the power. They weren't like degraded at that point. But now, in his own head, Day knows that. I mean, even the fact that he's considering this, I guess, is an admission of weakness. Yeah. The fact that he would ever consider getting married.
Right. Well, it reminds me of like when they, I think I just like a quote about like how empires end, and like it's always gradually and then all at once. So it's like you never, like, no one sees Rome falling until the barbarians are inside the gates burning it down. It's just like a slow, steady decline until you get to the level that you can be challenged, and then it happens. And I think that's what they're getting. And in fact, I even saw a little bit of this with the conversation in the next, where Dimmerzell takes him and it's like there's a deal, and, you know, Dusk and kind of Day are kind of like, we should launch our fleets and just kick Terminus's ass in. And Dimmerzell's like, well, we don't want, but she couches it like, we don't want an overreaction to turn the galaxy against it. But if you look at her face and study it, it's more of like, I don't know that she thinks the Empire can pull it off.
Gotcha. We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause.
Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info. And now, back with more Bald Move.
So it's like, we should go out there and take a look before we commit. Like, because, well, how humiliating would it be to launch, like, the Anacreon Thespis annihilation fleets, and you get there and the Foundation just handles you. Now you're done. Mm-hmm. You are done. So it's like,
you've lost your image too.
It's a big, it feels like it's a big poker bluff, and no one really knows what cards the other sides are handed. But I think that Day's demeanor is going to give the Queen Seraph a pretty big tell of what she's dealing with. And she's, and surely we've got lots more of her in the future. So,
well, I mean, in this scene, he is surprised by her free use of language here, I would say.
Uh-huh.
but he's not put off by it necessarily. He's more intrigued and thrilled. And I don't know if they've got spies kind of working within the palace there, and they know that Day has secretly been questioning everything. He's having this midlife Cleonic crisis.
I'm very curious to know what they know.
Yes, because they seem to be playing with everybody else's cards face up, and I don't know how they're doing that. Because it would be a huge mistake if this was Cleon the 10th, right? This is not how you approach that man.
Yeah. But so. Cleon the 10th would never approach him like this in the first place. So it's like the fact that this is different.
Like I said, it's an admission of weakness in itself, just entertaining this idea.
Yes. Yeah, like why after 17th dynasty, you know, you're just going to fucking take, you're going to roll the dice of reproduction, really?
Uh-huh. What's up? Can I just say, you shit on this gift shop level gift that he's giving. There, at least once every 5 minutes in the show, there is an item, a prop, a ship, something on screen that I would fucking love to have as a model kit.
To have on a shelf, yeah.
It'd be able to build one of these things and paint it up. Number one being the jump ship. Like, I think that jump ship is so freaking cool.
Yes.
When we have Goyer on, I'm going to pester him and say, you need to get on this. Expanse died because it did not merchandise correctly.
That's true.
Get on this, man. Get me some ships.
You couldn't get a decent Rocinante till the show was already dead and gone. You don't want
ridiculous.
That to happen. You get Ravel, get Tamiya, get testers on. Uh-huh. We need a kit.
Get Bandai in there. Yeah, somebody has got to make some kits for Foundation because I'm.
That's a good point. But honestly, if I was the queen, I would hold out for a platinum Trantor. Come on, bronze. What are we doing here?
Yeah.
What are we doing?
Weak. All right. Harry figures out that he's speaking to the Prime Radiant itself. It claims to be self-aware and helping him mend his broken mind. And he thinks his way out of the strange place he's in and walks into the light.
Interesting idea that the Prime... I want to say Meridian. That's not. It's Prime Radiant. Prime Radiant. The Prime Radiant is changing itself without Harry's awareness or guidance, and kind of hinting that that's what needs to happen to keep your plan. There's suddenly a lot of cooks in this here kitchen, and I don't know.
And one of them is acting a lot like ChatGPT, not knowing the difference between destiny and survival.
Yeah, that's another answer. I'm very interested in humanity's destiny. I can't wait till they slide into the trash bin of history. Like, yeah, that's...
Right. And the rise of the Prime Radiant species. Yeah.
Yeah, our survival's not the same as our destiny. Uh-uh. Yeah. Uh-huh. But she's leveling accusations that you got brain damage, dude. You're not ready to save shit.
Also true.
And what does she say? This is all the rage. Like, this is a big part of, not to spoil things, but in Three Body Problem, like the whole flattening and increasing dimensions and how that changes the topography of things and the size. And it's a bit like that. Seems like that's like the latest cool thing in sci-fi. And it's neat to see Foundation playing with that.
Yeah, I love it. There was another one of those scenes where I desperately needed subtitles that we didn't have, when she leans in and whispers to Harry, I'll explain more if you can meet me at...
Because I really cranked up the volume and got my headphones out. I think this is a lost in translation where it's intended to be intelligible. I can't wait. I'm going to actually watch this when it premieres because I want to see what... Because I'm betting that the subtitles say intelligible. You're in the driver's seat here, listener, because you know right away if I'm right or wrong. But yeah, I couldn't make it out either.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to go back once the episode is out and actually look at that line, because no amount of rewinding and cranking the volume was gonna fix that.
It sounded and looked like she said Hornsbeak.
Sure, meet me at the Hornsbeak,
the planet Hornsbeak of the Hornsbeak system.
At first, I thought she said, if you can beat me at something, like beat me at a game, because she is kind of playing games with him, but I'm not sure.
But she also said, will it be worth, like, you know, this goose chase will be worth it. She goes, oh, you'll appreciate it down to your bones. That made me think about the vault, which is literally constructed of his bones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that's a very tenuous connection. So it's just one of those things that I'm waiting to get more information on.
Mm-hmm. Then we get to the final scene where Gale and Salvor's ship has a fault that's going to take them a long time to fix, but they don't have time because of the impending hurricane. Salvor tells Gale to let Harry out of the Prime Radiant and into the ship's computer so he can fix it. But then I think before she can do any of that, Harry manifests on the ship and tells Gale that it's time they had a reckoning.
Yeah, I love Jared Harris manifesting on a ship and just screaming, Gale Dornick!
Yeah,
your ass is grass and I'm the lawnmower. It's good.
Yeah.
I will say that, like, when they're talking about, like, oh, if we don't get off this planet before the hurricane hits, we're gonna die. Nah. I think you guys just flood the ship, getting cryopods for like a month or so. You'll be fine. This ship will definitely survive a hurricane.
The ship surely will. Yeah.
Maybe they won't. Maybe their squishy meat sacks won't. But like, maybe they don't have stasis pods in there either.
Mm.
Anyway.
Yeah, but this is a oh boy kind of moment. Like, what does a reckoning between Gale and Harry look like? Especially if Harry is this damaged version of himself.
They still are in the middle of a hurricane. So like,
yeah,
you need it's not just that Gale is
not
Harry's
the time.
Coming out ready to fight. Like, this is not the time, old man. But.
Uh-huh.
He's folding four-dimensional space now. You don't give a shit about time.
Yeah. What are you going to say? Look, we'll have our reckoning. Get in the computer first. Fix this.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know about
that.
Pull
the software fault out of here.
But that's it. That's where we leave it. Big cliffhanger moment for us.
Yeah, curious to see what people think. Foundation at baldmove.com is how you get a hold of us to give your feedback. We will be either doing a supplemental feedback episode or be sliding feedback into this here section, depending on how much we get. Once again, foundation at baldmove.com is how you send us feedback in the future. You can follow us at twitter.com/baldmove to see what our latest releases are. You can also go to baldmove.com to find all of our podcasts and subscribe to them. And if you would like to continue to support us, a couple of things you can do: rate and review us wherever you're listening to podcasts. If you could give us some stars, a couple of kind words, that would help out. And then if you want to get our content sans ads and with lots more bonus features, check out our club at support.baldmove.com. Thanks for listening. I cannot wait to see where we go in this long, strange, twisting road that is Psycho History and Foundation. We'll be back next week with the next episode. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Respect and enjoy the podcast.